You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Driving around in a death trap? Fossil smog is killing almost 100,000 Americans a year. From UCL and University of Birmingham, Dr. Karin Vohra on the real cost of oil and gas in the USA. Few of us could name the third biggest greenhouse gas, the ins and outs of ozone and global warming, with Professor Bill Collins from University of Reading. This is Radio EcoShock. Americans die younger than men and women in the UK or Scandinavia, like 5 to 7 fewer years of life expectancy. There are many factors, but a big one is simple: living with lots of oil and gas pollution. From well sites all the way to our tailpipes and factories, fossil fuel robs years of life. These days you can't make such claims without a lot of proof. We have that now in a new paper called The Health Burden and Racial Ethnic Disparities of Air Pollution from Major Oil and Gas Life Cycle Stages in the United States. The lead author is Dr. Karin Vohra, a research fellow at the University of Birmingham and University College London. He is a specialist in environmental health and risk management with several previous papers on oil and gas pollution. From the UK, Karin Vohra, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, for having me.
Tell us about air pollution in India that motivated your work.
While I was growing up in northern India, I used to experience few instances of severe air pollution episodes, specifically around the festival of Diwali, and these would often combine in the months of October, November with periods of agricultural residue burning. And so what would happen, there would be days where we would not see any sunlight, and me and my family members, we would often experience like a lump in our throat because there was so much of particle pollution that was just there, but we never realized that, okay, there's just so much of pollution that's existing. So there was this complex mix of air pollution, both local because of the festival, and then there was transported pollution from the agricultural residue burning. And so that really motivated me to study, okay, we know so much about air pollution, but there was nothing that was effective. And unfortunately, even now, there's nothing that's effectively tackle that problem. And so I've always been motivated to understand more about air pollution and human health and what we can do to mitigate this problem and improve public health.
In 2021, you led a study finding 1 in 5 deaths around the world was caused by burning fossil fuels. A year later, you warned of premature mortality in fast-growing cities in the tropics. Why have you now turned to pollution in the United States?
So as I was describing, so we've always been interested in understanding more about air pollution and health. And when we conducted the study looking at the fossil fuels globally, we did target fossil fuels because it was one human sector, anthropogenic sector, that from emissions from which could be easily mitigated. And then when I started looking at tropical cities, the motivation for looking at those was because a lot of these cities did not have routine air quality measurements. And when we did this assessment, we did find that most of the air quality degradation that was happening in these cities was driven by increasing human activities. So I've always been targeting sectors or emerging and novel air pollution sources that need to be targeted and emissions from which need to be mitigated. And so it was a logical next step for us to investigate the U.S., where it's the world's largest oil and gas industry. So right now what was happening, reliance on coal was declining when we started this project. And we wanted to investigate what's the impact of the entire life cycle of the oil and gas sector.
Yes, in the last few years, the U.S. produced more gas and oil than Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Canada combined. The new administration wants to make even more. What price are Americans paying for this fossil energy dominance?
Yes, so we did a comprehensive health impact assessment. investigating the health burden across various age groups, from the unborn to the elderly population. And we did estimate 91,000 early deaths that were linked to the air pollution from the oil and gas life cycle. And we also estimated hundreds and thousands of incidences of preterm births, asthma in children, as well as cancer, all linked to air pollution from the oil and gas life cycle.
Was that 91,000 early deaths, is that from a period over a decade or two decades, or is that every year? What's the time period?
Yeah, there? So I'll clarify that. Yes, so these are annual. So 91,000 were the annual health burden, and we estimated these for 2017.
What are the toxic byproducts that you used in your study?
Yes, so we looked at a suite of pollutants that were there. So we looked at health-harming gases that range from nitrogen dioxide, which also form ozone. Then we also looked at cancer-causing hazardous air pollutants. So we looked at three of these. It included formaldehyde, benzene, and acetaldehyde. And then we also looked at the particle pollution, or fine particles that we typically refer to as PM2.5, because all of these pollutants, both gases and particles, were linked to the oil and gas.
Oil and gas leak toxic materials at every stage of production. And what are those stages in your study?
Yeah, so we looked at four major stages, and we referred to these as upstream, which focus around exploration, extraction, and drilling of oil and gas. The second one was midstream activities, focusing on storage and transportation. And then we went to downstream activities around refinement and transformation to petrochemical products. And the final one was end use or consumption.
And what pollution from oil and gas life cycle causes the most premature deaths?
Yes, so out of the three pollutants that we were looking at, PM2.5, or fine particles, NO2, and ozone, we did see that PM2.5 was linked to the most premature deaths. The estimates were around 47,200 deaths in adults aged 25 years and above. So this is around 2% of all of the deaths in adults in that year.
Your team found more than just shortened lives. Talk to us about childhood onset asthma and cancers.
So we did estimate 216,000 incidences of asthma in children under 18 years of age, which was a very large number. And we did see that this is around 10% of the total asthma incidences in the U.S. each year in children. And in terms of cancer, we looked at lifetime incidences of cancer, around 1,600 incidences, which accounts for around 4% of cancers each year in the U.S.
And mothers are also at risk. What about preterm births?
Yes, so mothers who are pregnant and they are exposed to PM2.5, specifically from the oil and gas sector, they are at risk as well. And we did estimate around 10,300 preterm birth incidences in the U.S., which accounts for around 3% of all of the preterm births in 2017.
Karin, should we assume toxic byproducts of fossil fuel use remain localized, or can they travel large distances in the wind?
This depends more on which pollutants we're looking at. For example, nitrogen dioxide is a short-lived pollutant, and so the effect is mostly localized. But when we talk around PM2.5, which is relatively long-lived, so the impact can be both localized as well as transported. For example, in Kansas, which had far less emissions from upstream activities than Oklahoma or Texas, still had 30 PM2.5-related deaths, and this is mainly because of transported air pollution. And similarly, we were also able to push the model and include southern Canada as well as northern Mexico in our domain. And we estimated 1,200 early deaths in Canada and around 400 early deaths in northern Mexico, all linked to PM2.5 from the oil and gas life cycle.
And which two states had the most health burdens and the worst loss of life expectancy?
Across all of the health burden, we found that California and Texas have the greatest health burden. So in terms of the premature mortality, there were 17,000 premature deaths in California and around 6,000 in Texas. In terms of preterm births, around 2,000 in California and 800 in Texas. In terms of cancer risk, 300 in California and 150 in Texas. And the most severe one was related to asthma in children, around 41,000 incidences in California and 26,000 in Texas.
That's not what we picture for California. They've been working on cleaner air regulations. There does seem to be a little less smog than back in the 1970s. So what's going on there?
The thing here is, for California, we did see that the greatest health burden was in this state, which is a result of mainly high air pollution levels as well as the dense population that is there. So both of these combined together do result in the greatest health burden being in California.
And there could be many causes of lower life expectancy, say for blacks in Louisiana, maybe poorer food or less health care, for example. How did this study isolate direct causes from oil and gas versus other factors in those states?
The health risk assessment models that we use in our study, they integrate a lot of these factors, and some of these factors are easy to isolate depending on the data set that we have. But in our study, the functions that we use to estimate the health impacts do not isolate these additional factors like socioeconomic status or access to poor food, or, for example, access to health care. And so it was very difficult for us to isolate these causes from the oil and gas sector.
And everything from large-scale studies through satellite data to government statistics reveals worse health impacts for black and Asian populations. Could you tell us about that?
This is something that we knew when we started this work, that there were certain communities that were exposed to inequitable exposures as well as health burden. And what our study does is puts numbers to these to quantify just how unjust those exposures and health burdens were linked to the oil and gas life cycle. And so for that, what we did was we estimated first the national values or national rates of early deaths, incidences of asthma, cancer, and preterm birth. And then we did the same for these population subgroups by race and ethnicity and compared them to the national values. And what we find is that for upstream activities, the health burden in the Native American population is 20 to 50% greater than the national value. For downstream stage, it was the black population where the health burden for the black population is 20 to 70% greater than the national value. And when we talk of end use, the early death rate and the preterm births in the black population is 20 to 30% greater than the national value. And in terms of asthma and cancer, incidences in the Asian population, this is 30 to 50% greater than the national value. So a lot of disparate health burdens that we saw by race and ethnicity.
Well, despite illness clusters around refineries and ports that ship oil and gas, the worst pollution by far, according to your study, comes from the end-use stage. What do you mean by that, and how big is the end-use stage in the picture of oil and gas harms?
When we talk of end use, we are talking mostly around consumption. And so this consumption, most of this air pollution that is linked to the end use stage is in regions that are densely populated. And so it's not a surprise that we saw most of the health burden linked to the end use stage. For example, 90 to 96% of the early deaths were linked to the end use stage. Around 94% of the preterm births were linked to end use stage. 91% of asthma incidences in children, as well as 82% of the cancer incidences were linked to end use.
So if I got this right, to get complete data, your study used 2017 as a baseline year. The tally of U.S. premature deaths and illness is shocking then, but hasn't the industry broadly expanded since then? Is the current situation likely much worse?
Yes, you're right. So we did use data for 2017 as a baseline year because that was the data, that was the year for which we had most of the data sets available. And the industry, like the oil and gas production, has increased between 2017 and 2023 by 40%, and consumption has increased by 8%. So it is likely that the situation is much worse and our estimates were very conservative.
You've also used figures from an Environmental Protection Agency database. Some of those numbers are industry reported, and outside studies have found much higher levels. And again, this sounds worse. Could we say, or should we say, the actual damages to Americans are higher than reported, but unknown?
We did rely on these existing studies, which showed that levels of certain emissions were much higher than reported from the Environmental Protection Agency database. And so we did collaborate with the experts from University of Colorado Boulder, and we constructed our own emissions data set. So we combined different existing emissions inventories in order to get the most contemporary as well as robust emissions of air pollutants for the U.S. linked to the oil and gas life cycle for 2017.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Karin Vohra about air pollution and the deaths from the oil and gas industry. In previous times, we might expect governments would become concerned with this data in your report and try to regulate every stage to reduce pollution. The current U.S. government and other governments in other countries are tossing out not just regulations, but even requirements to monitor or report air pollution. Is it possible this paper could not be produced for 2025 or 2026 as data disappears?
Unfortunately, that may be possible because data availability was very crucial for a comprehensive assessment like ours. For example, we were constructing emissions inventory where we had to rely on these multiple emissions data sets. We were using state-of-the-art model that does rely on funding from certain governments, and we evaluated these model outputs against observations that are possible because of the funding that's out there. And so once we have these model outputs, we are able to use health data, for example, from Center for Diseases and Control. So it's very crucial to have data, and without that, I don't think such a comprehensive assessment is possible in the future.
I don't often see studies with such detail about sources and methods. You must have anticipated criticism from fossil fuel lobbies. Have the authors received any pushback on this study yet? Do you expect it?
We've been very transparent in our methods, and the idea behind this was so we provide all the necessary details for such an important study to be replicated, not just for the U.S., but also for other regions as well. And so far, we not received any pushback directly, but neither did we when we did the 2021 study on global fossil fuels.
How does this paper fit into the eco-justice movement, which is already being actively repressed by authorities in the United States?
As I briefly discussed earlier, so ours was the first study which investigated the racial ethnic disparities that were linked to air pollution from the oil and gas sector. So for upstream and midstream activities, we were able to see that there is inequitable exposure for the Native Americans, Hispanic, and the black population, and in the black and Asian population, drink to the downstream stages as well as the end-use stage.
How many of these deaths are preventable? Did anyone calculate a spreadsheet of costs to cut pollution versus life saved? I mean, for example, are the specific parts of this life cycle that could be cleaned up at a relatively low cost, saving a lot of lives, versus other steps that would seem impossibly expensive for just a few lives saved?
In our study, so we are not health economic experts, and so it was very difficult for us to conduct such an assessment. But yes, it would be ideal to also have a follow-on study where we do a cost-benefit analysis and are able to quantify which or identify which should be those specific parts of the life cycle. It's definitely beneficial to transition to cleaner fuel, but it needs a comprehensive cost-benefit analysis to be able to comment on this.
The maps in this study are easy to understand. People near high oil and gas production and refining are at a much higher risk of premature death or birth. If current governments and corporations refuse to do anything about pollution, is the only option to move to a place with cleaner air?
I wish that was the ideal scenario, and it was easy to move to a place where the air is clean. But unfortunately, I think it comes at such a big price, and it may not be feasible for so many people around. And so I think the suggestion I think that's out there is to increase the active travel. We can probably increase activities like walking and cycling whenever possible. It may not be always possible, but if we are able to do that, we can definitely reduce the amount of fuel that we are using. And so we are indirectly reducing, we're directly reducing the pollution that's out there and indirectly reducing the demand that would be linked to the fuel use.
China is laying out solar farms the size of valleys. Suppose fossil fuel use falls significantly, even in the United States. There are climate benefits, obviously, but would people start to live longer with less disease simply by cleaning the air?
So when we talk on the benefits on the climate, these are typically realized only 50 or 100 years from today, and they'll most likely be for our future generations. But when we talk of cleaning the air, so we will definitely see the benefits from cleaning the air because there'll be less air pollution exposure, and it will reduce the adverse health impacts that we see. So definitely beneficial to simply clean the air.
Have you conducted a similar air pollution toll for India?
Such an assessment has been very challenging, and the first thing that we briefly discussed was around data availability. So such a data set where we are able to quantify emissions from each life cycle stage is not available for many countries, and even if it exists, then it's not publicly available. And so it's difficult to look at the air pollution toll for India, but what I'm currently looking at is investigating the impact that road transportation specifically has, because we can control road transportation in India.
And what else are you working on next?
Yeah, so we're looking at the impact of clean energy and equitable transportation solutions. So we're focusing on the US, UK, and India, and we're trying to see what is the health impact of air pollution from the present-day road transportation, and how likely or what are the kind of health benefits that we would expect to see if we adopt EV or electric vehicles in the future.
From UCL and University of Birmingham, we've been speaking with Dr. Karin Vohra. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Karin, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you so much, Alex, for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Ozone is a big factor in global warming. A new study led by University of Reading found ozone could be the second largest contributor to future warming by 2050. Ironically, efforts to restore the protective ozone layer may add to the climate shift. Let's investigate with lead author William J. Collins, professor of climate processes at University of Reading. He's been working and publishing on this sticky problem for 20 years. From Reading, UK, Bill Collins, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What is ozone? Could we see it in a jar?
Ozone is a gas in the atmosphere that's not very, certainly down at our level, is not very prevalent. It's a few parts per billion. That may not sound very much, but it can have important consequences for health and for climate. There's a bit more of it in the stratosphere when it can reach a few parts per million. Again, parts per million doesn't sound very much, but those parts per million in the stratosphere are enough to protect us from the worst radiation from the sun.
Is ozone a greenhouse gas in itself?
Yes, it is, yes. So greenhouse gases act by trapping the heat given off in the form of infrared radiation by the Earth, and ozone is very effective at trapping that heat. So yes, it acts as a greenhouse gas, both down at the troposphere, our level, and up in the stratosphere as well.
From the human perspective, ozone has two faces. In the upper atmosphere, it helps prevent cancer by shielding ultraviolet rays from the sun. Here on the ground, ozone is part of the smog that kills millions of people a year. So there's good ozone and bad ozone?
Yes, that's the way some people like to talk about it. I mean, I guess from a chemistry point of view, we just call it ozone. But yes, you're absolutely right. It's toxic to people and to plants as well. So not only does it mean that, yeah, we shouldn't breathe it, but it can actually damage crops and reduce crop productivity. So we've taken lots of steps over the last few decades, ever since it was identified really in Los Angeles that we were producing it down at ground level. So we've taken steps, or many countries have taken steps to reduce the pollutants that produce ozone. However, quite the opposite is true in the stratosphere. I mean, we wouldn't like to be up in the stratosphere breathing it, but so long as it's away from us, it's protecting us, as you said, from the ultraviolet rays from the sun, which would be very damaging both to us and to wildlife and to vegetation as well. So too much ultraviolet light would be hugely detrimental. And saving the ozone layer has been one of the big environmental success stories of recent decades. So countries around the world signed a protocol called the Montreal Protocol back in the 1990s. And that's been probably the most successful global agreement on environmental legislation we've ever had.
Yes, we hope that upper ozone level will recover and the ozone hole over Antarctica in particular will replenish itself. But you say that could contribute to more warming. How does that work?
Yes, well, as we were discussing earlier, ozone is a greenhouse gas, and it's also greenhouse gas even when it's up in the stratosphere, 20 kilometers high. So we definitely want that ozone to recover, because we would have severe environmental consequences if it didn't recover. But we pay a bit of a penalty in terms of the climate effect, because it's a greenhouse gas. This recovery will end up warming the Earth. There's a sort of a slight analogy here with ground level pollutants called aerosols. So these are particles that are very noxious to breathe in, and we don't want to, but they cool the climate. So we've taken strong action to remove particularly sulfur from fuels and so on, which has been good for health, but actually harmed increased global warming. But we've taken the viewpoint that actually direct damage to human health is more important to solve, and that we should maybe address the global warming issue.
Aerosol pollution does not actually add to the amount of warming by our emissions. I mean, smog stops the true energy imbalance from greenhouse gases from appearing. It cools us somewhat. Is that true of the upper-level ozone? I mean, if ozone manages to refill that hole, is it actually adding to warming, or is it revealing heating caused by other sources?
Yes, I guess you could argue that way. Whichever way it is, the world will be warmer if the ozone hole. But I think in terms of the lesser evil, it's more important for the ozone hole to recover and for us to address the climate problem through, as I said, we don't want to make the ozone hole worse just from a climate point of view, because that would be so damaging to the environment.
So the oxygen that we breathe has two atoms in it, and the ozone has three. And it is fascinating how three oxygen molecules get joined up. Tell us about the Chapman cycle.
So what happens is, high up in the atmosphere, when we get lots of ultraviolet radiation from the sun, that's strong enough to break up oxygen molecules. So oxygen, as you said, is O2. And if the sunlight can split that actually into two single oxygen atoms. So high up in the stratosphere, we have oxygen atoms, single atoms flying around. And if they hit another oxygen molecule, they can add on to it. So we go from an O2 to an O3, and that's how ozone is formed high in the stratosphere. So that's the basic formula for why we have the stratospheric ozone layer.
I did not know that ground-level ozone can also add to warming. How does that happen?
As with other greenhouse gases, ozone traps the heat that's given off by the Earth. So this is in the form of, we call it thermal infrared radiation, and that radiation is just in the wavelength that ozone and other greenhouse gases can absorb. And we often refer to it as the greenhouse effect, but I think a bit more is more useful to call it a blanket effect. Effectively, we're just stopping the heat given off from the Earth escaping, as much as it would if you wrapped a blanket around yourself.
Is the contribution of ground-level ozone to warming relatively small or significant?
I think it's reasonably significant. I mean, I'm particularly interested in ozone. It's something I've been studying.